It's so funny because I do feel like I'm uncovering the past and yet hopefully in some way can put a light on the future and on today and just open minds.
That is the unmistakable voice of the Tony Award-winning playwright and actor, Harvey Fierstein. I'm Elliot Forrest. In March, Harvey sat down with me for a conversation in front of a live studio audience. We talked about his new play, Casa Valentina, opening April 23rd at Manhattan Theater Club's Samuel J. Friedman Theater. Casa Valentina is the story of a group of mostly straight, married men who would, once a year, spend a weekend in upstate New York dressed as women. Harvey and I also talked about his upbringing in New York, his start in show business, his groundbreaking role in theater, and his work as an activist. And now, recorded live in the Jerome L. Green Performance Space, an hour with Harvey Fierstein.
Hello, everybody. Look at this. I'm so proud to be here. Hello. Thank you for having me here in your fishbowl.
So great to have you here. How does it feel to return to playwriting without having to worry about all that music?
It's really strange. It's much different than I thought it would be. It's been 30 years since I wrote a play, and basically because I was so really hurt and angry at critics for how they received plays of mine, and I just said, why bother? You know, you work your ass off. You struggle to show the audience something they've never seen before, and these idiots come in and say, oh, that couldn't. Like, I wrote a play called Safe Sex, in which nobody had AIDS. It was about AIDS, but in which I basically said, the world has now changed. This is, you know, the first or second year of age, you know, like really at the beginning. I said, the world has now changed. Our lives are forever changed. We will never touch each other as we did before. Our lives are different. And these critics came in, mostly heterosexual men. Don't start. And said, what is he talking about? AIDS is just a disease. It'll be gone in a year or two. It only affects gay people. It'll never affect the heterosexual community. And it's like, why did I pour my heart out? You know, I wrote a play called Spook House that was about a family whose kids, they forced the mother to put the kids on drugs to keep them in class, you know. No social worker would ever do that to a child. I said, why do I bother? I mean, I sat days and days in family court, listened to stories, said this is an important story to tell. You know, like 3 years later, stories started coming out about social workers. So I stopped writing plays, and I said, you want to see a nice dance number? We'll do a nice dance number. So I wrote Newsies, Kinky Boots, and Casa Valentina almost at the same time. I worked on the three of them at the same time because Cyndi Lauper was always on the road. Alan Menken was always writing 500,000 other things. And so when I couldn't get a hold of Cyndi or I couldn't get a hold of Alan, I could sit and write, you know, work by myself. You know, and then we put on Newsies. Newsies just celebrated its 2-year anniversary on Broadway. And April 6th, Kinky Boots celebrates its 1 year on Broadway. And Casa Valentina will open, so it'll be 1, 2, 3, just like that. But it's different. It's like, so I'm sitting at rehearsal, and I'm playing with my computer, and the director goes, Harvey! I go, what? Like, ask Cyndi. Oh, I don't have Cyndi. Ask Alan. No, I don't have Alan. It's like,
it's you.
You have to know the answers.
Right, it's all you.
It's all you. And that's the hard part, too. The hard part is it's all you, but the good part is it's all you. You know, and it comes out of that place, and especially this play.
Let's talk about this play.
Let's talk about this play.
It's called Casa Valentina. I venture to say that Broadway audiences have never seen this subject or these characters ever on Broadway. Is that a fair assumption?
I didn't know these people really existed.
You didn't
I
know
knew
that.
They existed, but I had no idea really what was going on.
So let's be clear about this, and I think terminology is very helpful. So decipher for us the difference between cross-dressing, drag queen, transvestite, female impersonator.
Drag queens, my world, basically, or drag kings, put on the sex and the characteristics of the opposite sex to entertain, to lampoon sometimes, to exaggerate, to become. It is in all of us. the mystery of the other sex is built into all of us. All men, straight or gay, cross-dressers or not, have ideas of what it would be like to be a woman, that women have all the power, and they imbue women with these mystical powers. Women have the same thing about men, that men have all the power, and they, you know, and then when you take on that other guy's, it is an incredibly powerful thing to feel. You can see it in examples of Marlene Dietrich. In a tuxedo, is there anything sexier than that? You know, so that's drag kings, drag queens. Transgender people is an identity thing where they believe they were born into the wrong body, that it's a male who really believes that he was meant to be a female and need to, though less and less, but need to change the physical to match the emotional to match. Transvestites, which is the subject of the people in Casa Valentina, transvestites wear the clothing of the opposite sex, and it looks like they have something in common, and it doesn't. Transvestites can have a billion reasons for wanting to do it. Some, it is a gender dysphoria. Sometimes it's a sexual thing of just the kick of wearing the, of once again, the mystical. Sometimes it's an identity. Sometimes it's something from childhood that they're bringing forward. A lot of times it's sexual. There can be, you know, there are people who just putting on the sex, the clothing, the undergarments of the opposite sex, that gets them off and that's all they need. There's a billion reasons. I always knew that no two people were alike. What I had absolutely no idea was there was this whole universe of heterosexual men, and I don't know about women. I have not really done the work on women. You know, this is always next year. But there's this whole universe of heterosexual transvestite men who are faceless and voiceless, who we don't understand. We don't have a feeling for who they are or what they want. And I knew nothing about them, really. I knew they existed. I mean, you know, when La Cage aux Folles first opened, we had transvestites all the time at La Cage. You know, it was a great place for them to go.
And I, as audience members.
As audience members. And I, you know, I mean, even in my own life, in, you know, I live in a small fictional town in Connecticut, and they show up there all the time. You know, there's a math teacher of our local high school who has a little trailer attached to the back of his car, and he goes to the gay bar. We have, like, on Route 7, there's, like, it's like darkness, gay bar. And and he goes to this gay bar, and he parks in the back in the parking lot, climbs into the little wagon that he pulls, and gets up in full drag, and then sits at the bar all night. He's not there to pick up anybody. He just wants to be in his clothing, in her clothing, and draws other patrons, and then just hands you the drawing that he did of you. And I, and you know, and then and people come in and go, oh, that was my history teacher. You know, so I knew, but I didn't know. So these guys who are antique dealers were down in Chelsea, uptown in the flea market, and they were looking around, and there was a box of photographs, and they picked it up, and they looked, and they said, look at these ugly things. And they were sort of laughing, and they went, there's something different about these people. It isn't quite ugly drag queens here. This is something else, and they didn't know what it was. And they did some research and found out about this place called, they got all their facts wrong, but they found out about this place called the Casa Susana. And they put out a book, which has lots of photographs of the actual people. My father was born in Ellenville, and so we would go up to the Catskills all the time, and we knew that this place existed. But as I tell people, there was this place where the heterosexual men put on women's clothes, but right across the road was a nudist colony. So f*** the people in the dresses. We wanted to see the naked people. We were kids. We wanted to see naked people. So, you know, we didn't pay much attention to that at all. So anyway, but Colin Callender, I did a movie on HBO called Tidy Endings. It was basically a two-character, Stockard Channing and I, and he had produced that for HBO. And he kept calling me saying, Harvey, I really wish you'd write about this. I really wish you were. So I said, you know what? I'll do some research, I'll see. And then I started doing research. And as I started doing research and uncovering their stories and their writings and their and who they were and started realizing this incredible, complex life, I said, but why? We're in 2014 and nobody knows what a heterosexual transvestite is. How did that happen? And I kept doing, and I found this weekend in 1962. I mean, I have exaggerated some, and I've taken some from, because it really took place over a few months, actually. But I basically created this weekend in which this group of men, who would call themselves girls, got together and formed a national organization called the Trieste Sorority. They formed this sorority, which exists to this day, and became nonprofit and went sort of public. But what happened was, because they felt, or a couple of the leaders felt, that the most misunderstood thing about them was their sexuality, that their wives knew they went up to the Catskills to do this, but that the wives thought they were all having sex up there with each other, that homosexuality was the greatest danger to this community, that the idea that people saw they wear dresses, therefore they're queers, was destroying them, that society would never, ever accept them as long as people thought they could be queer. They voted and made the organization heterosexual only. And 50 years later, the interesting thing to look at, there's a line in the play where Charlotte, who owns the publishing company and everything, says, 50 years from now, when homosexuals are still the back alley vermin of society, we will be dressing and as normal as smoking cigarettes. And really believe that that's how they would. So they separated themselves out, as we all know. The gay movement went on, even the transgender movement, but they banned clothing fetishists, transgender people, and homosexuals. And 50 years later, nobody still knows who they are. And 50 years later, they're still voiceless. And I felt like I can't explain to an audience, because there's no two people with exactly the same reason they do it, but I can at least bring them out to an audience, have people see how very human they are, have people see this struggle, have people see this unbelievable joy. That's the hardest thing for people to see, this unbelievable peace that happens when a man who feels uncomfortable in men's clothing puts on a dress and can breathe. And it's a strange concept, you know, to me. And I do it for a living, so I have to imagine it is to most. Over the years, not in the play, over the years, the wives actually put out a Bill of Rights, a wives' Bill of Rights. You know, you cannot borrow my clothing without asking. You cannot tell my relatives what you do without my permission. You cannot show up at family dinners like that. You know, they actually put out like a 10-point Bill of Rights.
You deal with this in the play. A little bit about the family's reaction.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are heterosexual men with wives, with children, who did this. The wives, some of the wives would go up for the weekends. I love it. You know, this is, you spent 3 days up there, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all food and booze included, $25. Tell me you wouldn't put on a dress for that kind of deal. I'd wear a dress all weekend for that kind of deal. In the Catskills.
I'm Elliot Forrest with Harvey Fierstein talking about his new play, Casa Valentina. You know, I've been talking to friends about this play since I read it, and everyone references this article from about, I guess, maybe 2 years ago in the New York Times. About a young boy in the camp that they were able to take their son to a camp in which there were lots of other boys who could also dress up. In the article, a psychologist called it this middle space between traditional boyhood and traditional girlhood. Is that a good way to think about this for you?
You know, I'm writing about characters 50 years ago. And if you, and you know, 1962, more 52 years ago now, but 1962 was such an, the male role and the female role was so well defined that it was almost easy to be a woman because you knew exactly what you were allowed to do and what you weren't. The same for men. So the space between what I've come to understand, and I'd love to get it through to an audience, though I don't know how you do it in 2 hours, is that there is no space between. There are no two of us. I don't care how much you think you have in common with each other. You have nothing in common with each other. I'll give you an example. I have gay friends now who I would think, you know, I grew up with these gay people. We all party together. But they have children. and their interests are going on play dates. And they have to go to the school for a teacher conference and all. What's that for a friend? I have, you know, so outwardly it would look like the two, like we are close friends and we belong together. But the truth is we're very much individual. And the truth is that among my homosexual friends, my sexual appetites are very different than somebody else. You know, when I wrote, I mean, just for example, when I wrote Torch Song Trilogy, I was attacked by the gay community for saying that I wanted to be in a stable relationship. I wanted to have children and all that. You know, it's like, who the hell? You know, gay people, we that's like make-believe heterosexuals. Well, you wouldn't say that anymore, you know. And the truth is that we all have different reasons for doing what we do. We all have different hungers. We all have different needs. We all relate to each other differently. And it would be great. It would be great. I mean, I feel so John Lennon. But it'd be so great if the words of Imagine were the truth, you know, if we could get rid of all the churches and the countries and all that, because we are all just a f***ed up mess. Which makes us just fine. You know, they did these studies on who's happiest in their lives, and what they found is the people that say they're happiest and or most satisfied with their lives, the people that they found were happiest in their lives were married, didn't have children, were married, belonged to a church that they were very active in. You know, in other words, their whole definition of their life was mapped out for them. They didn't ask no questions. They didn't get up in the morning and say, who am I today? That's a recipe for unhappiness. Well, unhappiness or art. But the truth is that you can live that kind of dead life. You can, but it's, you know, I didn't make up the line about the unexamined life, you know. I mean, other people have figured that out too. But what amazes me is if I went into a church, I could find people whose lives are much more to do with my life than the person sitting next to them in that pew that they spend all their time with. We are all so individual. And it would be great to just not judge each other. I mean, isn't that the ultimate goal? And what happens in Casa Valentina, of course, is just how painful it is to examine your own life. It's a very funny play, but in the long run, there's a lot of denial going on that stage.
There's a line in the play that some of us try to make sense of us and some of us don't. I mean, I couldn't help but think of the analogy, especially in the writing that you've been doing for 30 years, with homosexuality. It seemed like there was a time that people would go, well, why are you gay, or why are you a cross-dresser in this particular case, or what's the cause of it, or in some worst-case scenarios, what's the cure for it? You sort of cover that in this story about these men in this resort.
I think what's the cause of it is the most the simplest reason. Because I am human. I mean, we're not born with the same brains. You know, we're all born with all kinds of crap left over from when we were animals. You know, like wanting to be with people like each other, you know, with being afraid of strangers. I mean, there's all kinds of instincts we were born with that our intellect allows us to get over. And then our society shoves us into roles, and then we're all educated the same, which is really stupid when you understand a child's brain. To try and educate two children with the same lesson is ridiculous. It doesn't work. But the fact is that we're human. What that guy says in that scene when he says to some, there's a guy who comes to the Casa Valentina for his very first time. He's never been out of the. He's dresses only in the basement. He when his wife is away, he goes down to the basement where his clothes are locked up, and he has a cheval mirror, and he dresses and he puts on the radio, and he never goes upstairs even because there are windows, and he lives in this basement, and he finally comes to the Casa Valentina, and it's all so frightening. It's so frightening to him. And he says, you know, I read in your magazine, because they published a magazine called Transvestia. And he says, I read in your magazine, you know, and you make it sound so organized, like 50-50. He says, you make it sound so, and he says, organized. He says, that's funny. He said, it's not true. He says, no, it's advertising. He said, well, what do you think of yourself? And he said, I think of being a man as my day job. And that works for him. That works for him. He puts on his suit, as many people do. They put on their suit, they put on that personality, they go out into the world, and they are who they're supposed to be in the world. And then they come home, and the real them somehow. And the real you can frighten the hell out of you if you know who it is. It's not a comfortable place to be.
You have an amazing cast. Talk about some
amazing
of the
cast.
Talk about some of the actors in this.
Gabriel Ebert, who won the Tony last year for Matilda,
played the father.
He played the father, the really tall, thin one. He plays Miranda, who's very first time it is to come out of the basement. So we go from somebody in his 20s to John Cullum.
Oh yeah.
And he looks pretty too. He looks like Dame Judith Anderson. John Cullum in a beautiful curly wig. And he plays Terry, who's the oldest member of this group. We have Larry Pine. Do you know him? What's his TV show now? House of Cards.
Oh.
He's in House of Cards, and he plays the judge. We have Patrick Page, you know, who's Scar from Lion King and the villain from Spider-Man, and you know, and
many things.
And he plays
a beautiful voice.
He has that gorgeous voice, and he plays Valentina, and has a very good time doing it. Playing his wife is Mayor Winningham, and Lisa Emery plays Larry Pine's daughter. Tom McGowan plays a role that I wrote for myself, that I backed out of playing, and I backed out. I mean, truthfully, I backed out because of the critics, because I said, they will never be able to see me because they're so, like I said, I have not a lot of respect.
Why do you
for
care
people.
That much about what they
because,
say?
Because they define what a play is. They, you know, it's not that I have respect for them, but they are part of my dealings. I mean, I'm in a business, you know. I mean, I'm in a business, and they are part of my business, and I have to, and to ignore them is to be really stupid. And so, but I felt that they will never accept me playing a heterosexual. They will always say, well, Harvey's playing that role, so the role's really gay. You know, as they're saying, well, because they all think that character's gay, because he quotes Oscar Wilde a lot. And they keep going, well, what about him? He quotes Oscar Wilde a lot. He even threatens to do all of Ballad of Reading Jail. So, in the original Irish accent. So I did a reading of it, and I said to Joe Mantello's directing it. You know, he directed Wicked, and, you know, he's got a couple of Tony
great
Awards.
Director.
He's a great director. And I said to Joe, wanted me to do it, and I said, you know, Joe, I'm going to get in the way of those people seeing the play for what it is. The audience never has a problem. I mean, no audience ever had a problem with me doing Fiddler on the Roof. You know, no audience ever. But leave it to, you know, some people writing, and Harvey Fierstein playing a mean. So you ask why, because you have to deal with these people. You know, you do. You have to deal with them.
Let me ask you about...
Tom's doing a great job, so I'm really happy.
And Reed Birney
and, I'll do the movie.
And Nick Westray.
And, yes, Reed Birney. You know Reed Birney. He's what show is he on right now? I turned on the TV the other night, and he was on. Is he on House of Cards?
They're all on House of Cards.
Is everybody on House of Cards? No. Anyway, Reed Birney and Nick Westray.
So it's not just any role, but these are great actors. So what's it been like for them to deal with makeup and high heels?
We Joe did a really smart thing. A friend of mine, Jason Hayes, who's a makeup and hair person, he did me for Hairspray for years. We brought him in to design the show. He did, do you remember a movie called Transamerica with Felicity Huffman playing a transgendered
right.
person?
Yes, right.
He designed her makeup for that. And he actually, in real life, works with transvestites. He designs makeup and teaches lessons and hair and all that. So we brought in Jason and an assistant, and we just had a room. And we had this big room, and down the center of the room, we had this huge table, starting with black hair at one end and white hair at the other, and then wigs as far as the eyes could see. And they were all laid out there. Then in the next room, we had makeup tables and stuff like that. And then the next room, they had dresses and just like house dresses and slips and stuff like that on a rack and shoes and stuff. And everybody was brought in and sort of, you know, no pressure, but nobody was sort of doing anything. And I'm sitting there going, they're like sitting around drinking coffee and sort of looking at the wig and looking away like that. So I finally walked up, you know, and started slapping wigs on my head going, oh, this one's you. And I started throwing them around. They started putting them on. And then, and they did that for 2 days. And now everyone rehearses all day long in shoes. Some wear stockings, some don't. Some have shaved, some haven't. They wear dresses, and they wear wigs and lipstick. And the thing that you have to understand most about the transvestites that I'm writing about is they are more comfortable and more in their own skin when they're dressed as they see themselves in their mind. The drag relaxes them, makes them feel authentic. And I think that's a really good word, authentic, for who they become and who they are. So I needed, well, we needed the actors to feel authentic when they were on stage. Because some of them you see as men and women, but most of them you just see as women, and you need to see them just totally. I mean, you haven't lived until you've watched me give John Cullum a lesson in crocheting. Because he sits and crochets all through the play, and or John and Gabriel slow dancing together, you know, both in dresses. You know, it's like you look over and there's these two women dancing in the corner, and it's lovely.
It would be easier if there was a whole crew of makeup people backstage, but if I understand it right, for this weekend that you've written about, most of them show up as guys, so they put the makeup on themselves.
Yeah, and then remember, they're not drag queens,
right?
I mean, if you looked at the photographs of the,
it's not drastic.
It's not. It's a little base to cover their beards. It's a little mascara and some lipstick, and you know maybe a little blush, but that's it. Their goal, their highest goal is to go out in the street and pass and have nobody question that they're a woman. They become comfortable about going out, and depending on who the person is, that's what they want most, is to just be accepted. There's a moment in the play when finally they push Valentina to the edge. All this stuff has happened, and finally his wife is screaming at him, saying, "You've done all of this, or you let it all happen. What is it you want? You obviously want something. You wouldn't have let this happen. What do you want?" And he says, "I want to be normal." He said, "I go out as a man, and nobody questions that I'm a man. No question in the world, no matter how uncomfortable I feel dressed as a man, no one questions that I'm a man. But I put on my dress and I put on my wig and I go out on the street and I'm a freak. No matter how much I feel I am Valentina, I just want to be normal."
There's an epilogue in the script. I'm curious how that's going to be handled, because you really talk about the trieste that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's just for the actors to know. But no, we sort of decided. There's in the script, I tell you what happened to some of the people and what happened. Like I said, the organization Trieste.
It exists.
Still exists now.
You can go and see their website.
Oh, yeah, you can go to a meeting. You know, you can...
They have chapters all over the country.
Chapters all over the country, though the Jersey one just closed, somebody told me. They couldn't get across the bridge. Couldn't get across the bridge. So, but yes, the Trieste still exists. Valentina, the two sort of leaders of the group, both ended up, their marriages ended, and they both ended up living out the rest of their lives as women. In fact, Virginia Prince, who was really the founder of the modern movement, just died in 2009. She just died. She died in her 90s, but lived as a woman. Nobody knows what happened to the real Valentina. The wig shop, his wife owned a wig shop on Fifth Avenue. The wig shop closed. She left him. He lived out, we know he lived out the rest of his life as a woman, but we don't really know where. And there's one person, I'm happy to say, Catherine Cummings, who went to the Casa as a young student. Before there was a resort called the Chevalier d'Eon. And then after the Chevalier d'Eon failed, they opened the Casa Susanna or the Casa Valentina. This play takes place at the Chevalier d'Eon. And Catherine used to go there when she was very young. Catherine has since had a sex change and lived out her life as a woman in Australia. She's a librarian. She's going to celebrate her 80th birthday with us. She's coming for the whole preview period. She's sort of been my guide into this world. She's the only person that will speak to me that was around in that period. There are a few others around, but they really don't want to talk about it. They don't want to go public at all and scared to. So, but Catherine's been really wonderful. And her daughter, she has two daughters and a son. One of them is a writer for Vanity Fair, and she'll be writing a story about all of this and how it's affected her life. She'll be with us, and you know, that part's sort of exciting, and it's just, I don't know, you know, it's so funny because I do feel like I'm uncovering the past, and yet hopefully in some way can put a light on the future and on today and just open minds. The play's very different than I thought it was going to be.
What way?
It's because no one screams and yells at each other. You know, there's no, like, in a dramatic scene, there's none of that. Everything is so inside and so incredibly painful. The joy is in the spine. The pain is in the spine.
So as you're writing, is there things thought out and mapped out, or things just sort of come out from your typewriter and fingers?
The play takes place, like I said, 1962. We actually spoke English back then. We actually had vocabularies. We actually read books and crap.
Crazy.
So what I did was, every day before I'd sit down to write, I'd watch at least two or three episodes of an old game show. Like What's My Line or whatever, where people actually still spoke English. You know, like, you know. And that's why you're sitting back there. He said, what about queen for a day? I've been queen for 50 some odd years. A day my ass. The one that, What's My Line, really, John Daly spoke so beautifully, or Kitty Carlisle, those panelists, right. They spoke very differently than we do now. So I would sit and I'd listen to them for an hour or so before I'd start to write and make sure that I had that in my head. The play is, it's not thick with language, but the language is definitely different than we speak now, and very pointedly so.
I'd like it to take a little bit of a turn and find out how you came to the theater and came to this
Subway.
Particular life. You didn't come from I know. You didn't come from a showbiz family.
No.
But your parents took you to a lot of things. You went to the ballet. You went to the theater. What was that drive to instill the culture in you?
It was that Jewish cultural thing. You know, my mother had quit school in the seventh grade, I think. My father was dropped out of school at third grade. He was brought up in an orphanage in the Catskills. So as soon as he was old enough to work, it was, you know, get the hell out of school and go earn a living. And my mom had to leave school to help support the family because she had a brother, and the brother, you know, was going to go to college and all that, which a girl wasn't going to do. There's a line in Cosmology that says, well, in my day, the girls had to be smart. The boys just had to be pretty. But she loved culture. She loved culture. And my father worked in a factory manufacturing handkerchiefs his whole life. But my mother loved culture. So back then, you could actually buy Broadway tickets for $3. She would buy four tickets for $12. The front row of the balcony, which is now called the mezzanine, or, you know, I mean, it's not the same names, but she always bought the dead center front row and would order them. You know, she had Stubbs, remember the magazine Stubbs? And she'd order the tickets, and we saw everything. We saw the Royal Ballet when they came to America. We saw the Royal Shakespeare Company when they came to America. We saw, you know, everything from Oliver to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We went to museums. We went to Radio City to see the, you know, when movies would premiere at Radio City. She just loved that. Well, one day we go to the theater to see this thing called Fiddler on the Roof, which I assume was going to be, you know, like about a, you know, a, I don't know, an orchestra player or something. I don't know, Fiddler on the Roof. And the curtain goes up, and this man with tzitzis comes walking out on stage. Tzitzis, that's a little prayer shawl. I could do Fiddler for you right now. So tzitzis, and then all of a sudden he said, you know, tradition, and the whole stage filled with Jews. And they would talk like Jews. And I was dying. I was dying. I couldn't believe it. All right, so.
And who was playing Tevye?
It was Zero. It was Zero, and then we went back to see. Because, you know, he only played it for 8 months. And then we went back, and I saw Herschel Bernardi. I saw a bunch. Anyway, so let's fast forward 40 years or whatever. I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. And, you know, which was just a really unbelievable experience for me, for my family, you know, that it would come around like that. So one day I come out of a matinee. On Wednesdays, you get a lot of Hasidim. Wednesdays and Sundays, you get a lot of Hasidim. And I can't tell you that feeling to look out in the audience, because, you know, Tevye speaks directly to the audience, to look out in the audience and see nuns sitting there next to chassids, and, you know, and that with a, you know, a soccer team and then girls. I mean, it was just unbelievable to know you were reaching that audience. But I come out to sign autographs, and I'm walking along, and all of a sudden there was this little boy with payas, with the curls, and he's standing there waiting for an autograph, but he's looking at me. Such a look. And I looked at him and I said, Cookie, are you okay? And he looked up in my eyes and he said, are you really a Jew? It was like over for me. I just paid that back. Just paid it back.
A lot of people came to know. As a matter of fact, I was telling you when we first met that I had moved to New York in the 80s, and the first play I took my mom to was Torch Song Trilogy. And there was a lot of stuff in there. I was just like, not going to be looking at my mom as I went. But in researching it, you really grew up in La Mama. There was another theater that really, they embraced you. How old were you when you started working there?
Really young, because what happened was I was an art student. And a friend of mine in my freshman year of high school, her mother was starting a community theater group. So she said, can you get some friends out to make posters? So we made posters. Then you want to pull curtains. Then we want to make sets. You want to act. I mean, so all of a sudden I was in community theater. But there was an ad in the paper for Andy Warhol having auditions. Warhol wasn't so big then; it was 1971. But I mean, you know, but to an art student, this was like, oh my God! I had done all these woodcuts of Viva and Ultraviolet, and you know, I loved the whole Warhol thing. So I went down. Who wasn't going to go audition? And I'm like walking down the street. I'll never forget walking down the street, and I'm going back and forth down East 4th Street, you know, between Bowery and 2nd Avenue. And, you know, there's supposed to be a theater here, and there's a theater on the one side, the Truckin Warehouse, and there's a theater, but I can't find this La Mama thing. And there's an old black woman sweeping the sidewalk. And she says, baby, what's the matter? And I said, I'm looking for La Mama. She says, this La Mama, come on. What was La Mama? It was her. It was Ellen Stewart, who became my second mother, because I stayed at La Mama from 71. When we rehearsed, even when I did the Broadway production of Torch Song, we rehearsed it at La Mama. We always went back to La Mama. She always gave me the basement. That was Harvey's basement. And I did Haunted Host. We rehearsed there. All the three plays of Torch Song were premiered there. Safe Sex, I did there first. So it remained my home. She died 3 years ago. So, yeah.
And when Torch Song opened on Broadway, it's almost hard to remember that it was billed, and especially in interviews, you would do interviews, the first openly gay writer to star on Broadway. I mean, there'd already been Tennessee Williams. There's a big history here.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe.
Hard. I mean, you
have always felt so comfortable with that. Was there any hesitation?
No. It was not comfortable. It was who I was. I wasn't, you know, people say, well, you were so brave, you changed the world. And I didn't change it for you. I changed it to make it safe for me. That's what we do. We make a place for ourselves, and we make a place. And hopefully, if you're true and you're right, and it will. But you can't. There's no sacrifice. You have to change the world. You got to start by changing you.
I'm Elliot Forrest with playwright Harvey Fierstein talking about his new play Casa Valentina.
Of course, I knew you wrote Torch Song Trilogy and La Caja Folle. If you had asked me before I started looking this research, I would not have remembered or guessed that they overlapped. I thought there was so much more time between the time you did Torch Song.
Torch Song opened and ran, you know, at the end of the first year, I went off and opened La Caja Folle in Boston, and then we brought it into the city.
So you're like 20-something.
I turned 30 during the run of La Cage, during the first year of La Cage, yeah.
So you've done this off-Broadway thing, you've become a big celebrity doing Torch Song Trilogy, and then this
celebrity.
You get matched up with Mr. Hello Dolly and Mame. How did that partnership come about?
Carol
Channing.
Carol
got you to Jerry Herman.
Carol. No, what happened was Alan Carr owned La Caja Folle. He'd been trying to put it together for like 8 years. Jay Preston Allen was writing the script. Remember Jay Preston Allen? She wrote, she won the Academy Award for, you know, Little Piggy, what's that, Lord of the Flies. she wrote that. Mike Nichols was directing it. Maury Esten was writing the score. Going nowhere. They'd moved it to New Orleans. They called it the Queen of Basin Street. They asked me to come in. I said, okay. Alan Carr gave me a $10,000 check. I went to the meeting. I'm between proud and ashamed to say, in a down coat that was held together with gaffer's tape. You know, I mean, I worked for La Mama. If I made $50 a week, it was a lot. And I went to that meeting like that, and the man showed me a $10,000 check. I didn't come from a family that $10,000 was like 2 years' salary for the household. So I was kind of blown away, so I said yes. And then they handed me a tape of Maury's score, and I went, oh, my God. I love Maury. I love him, and we're very good friends now. But his idea of like the moment of I am what I am was, I am a person. I have feelings. I know different than you. I have eyes, I could see. I have ears, I could hear. I said, really? So then they called me up and said, and they brought in Fritz Holt and Barry Brown, who were friends with Jerry, and they said, would you like to write it with Jerry? And I said, yes, and then Jerry and I, and then they brought in Arthur Lawrence, and we wrote that show in maybe 4 months. We wrote that whole show. Never did anything but cut. So, but yeah, it happened very fast. And you know, Jerry and I, you know, we had this child 30-something years ago together, and we still talk.
It's like a marriage.
Oh, it's a definite marriage. We are tied together. We, you know, when we have a disagreement, no one will ever know except the two of us. We talk to each other. We give every answer about allowing this production, this. Together, we, you know, we've been doing that for 30-something years, but it's a definite marriage, and that's our child.
And another first, just a flat-out love song between two men that had never been seen before.
No.
Though the time tumbles by, there is one thing that I am forever certain of. I hear la, da, da, da.
That was Gene Barry and George Hearn from the original cast recording of La Cage aux Folles. I'm Elliot Forrest in the Green Space with Harvey Fierstein. You're responsible for so much groundbreaking stuff.
That was, you know, there was a lot of stuff. You know, you read Arthur Lawrence's book and you know, or even Jerry's book, and I read those and I say, well, that's why they say there's no fiction like nonfiction. The two of them were so uptight. I mean, they both went to opening night with women dates.
To La Cage.
Yeah. Jerry Herman went with a woman. Arthur Lawrence sat there with Shirley Bernstein. You know, the first time I said to Arthur Lawrence, I'd like gay people to play these roles, I thought he was going to have a heart attack and die. Gay people in my show? Well, you know, the characters are gay. Yeah, it doesn't matter. But anyway, yes, it really was something to be there in Boston. You know, I had flown in. I had just won 2 Tony Awards for Tort Song on Sunday night. The following Saturday, I left Tort Song, flew to Boston for the first preview of La Cage. One of those magical nights, you know, the music started to play. Da, 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 da. There's two big buildings on stage. Da, da, da. So they split open and fell. An hour and a half later, we tried it again. Da, da, da. But when the two of them sat down at that cafe table and sang that song, and you saw, I mean, at that first preview, you saw straight couples reach for each other's hand and hold each other's hand as they sang this song. I actually thought I was going to throw up. It was that kind of exciting. Jerry kept hitting me. Saying, "You're being too noisy." I was like dying. It was wonderful.
And you got to play Albin. Did you ever
Which
think?
Which I never planned on doing. No, I never.
Never thought about it?
No, I mean, I was writing an older person. I wrote it when I was in my 20s. I never thought of doing it. I knew how Jerry Herman was about having his music sung. You know, he didn't exactly want it sung by a voice like this. But what happened was... it's really a very long story, but the short version is it was either I did it or we closed. So Jerry said, you know what? Giga's into hate. So I went into rehearsal, and it was wonderful because I had to discover it as an actor. I put things back that Arthur had cut out. I put lots of little things. Well, to give it an example, just give you one example. Oh, here's a good example. You remember in Act Two when they dress Albin up as a man to come to dinner? Well, it was always done where they put an ill-fitting suit on him or a bad wig or whatever, and they always had him look stupid. And that's not what I wrote. So I get there, and even the production I was taking over, Doug Hodge wore an ill-fitting suit and all that. And I said, no. Said, make me the most beautiful suit you can make me. And they said, what the hell are you doing? Because I'm the bar mitzvah boy. It's the bar mitzvah boy who puts on the suit and he looks adorable and the whole family's going, look, Tatala, look what you look like. You're so adorable. And he's so unhappy to the core being in those clothes. It's such a lie to him. It's such a everything he's not. And I said, that's what I want. And so I did it that way, and I came out, and I looked really nice. And then I just stood there, and I just shook. and then started to cry, and the audience knew.
Let me ask you about Newsies, because I only vaguely heard the backstory that there's this, that it was a movie and it wasn't that great. And then you had stepped forward and said, lost a lot of money. And then you said, let me have that. I think there's something there. Is that close?
What happened was Alan Menken lives about 3 miles from my house. And we've never worked together, which is sort of a joke. I could walk to his house. And... you know, and I've always admired him from afar. And Cindy wasn't... I had called Cindy to write Kinky Boots, and she wasn't calling me back. And I said, I'm going to call Alan Menken. So I called Alan. I said, watch this movie, and I'm going to come over to your house. Meanwhile, Cindy called me. So I got to... And said yes. So I got to Alan Menken's house, and he said, I love it. I said, don't even. Don't even. It's not yours. I'm writing it with somebody else. And he said, ugh. And... But we're sitting there in his office over the garage. 8 Academy Awards, and he writes over the garage. The turtle has a $1 million home they built for it. He's writing over the garage. Every time somebody comes and goes, we have to stop. Anyway, maybe it's part of his process. I don't know. But if I ever win 8 Academy Awards, I'm not writing in the garage. So we're sitting there in the room over the garage. And I said, we got to do something together. What do you want to do? And he's like bouncing names or whatever. And I see the poster on the wall for Newsies. I say, you know, I used to use that movie when my nephews were little to babysit them. Because the boys just loved all that boy dancing. And he said, oh, he said, don't even look that way. We did. We tried to do it as a musical. We had a workshop of it. We worked on it for 3 years. Forget it. It won't work. I love a challenge. I said, give it to me. So he said, Harvey, don't. I said, did I ask you for a dime? I didn't ask you for any money. Leave me alone. I'm going to do this. He said, well, I'd love it. And so I said, just don't tell Disney. By the time I got home, Disney was on the phone. Tom Schumacher, Harvey, don't waste your time. It'll never work. We already spent 3 years. And I said, just, did I ask you for anything? Just leave me alone. He said, well, I'll give you a different composer. I said, the whole point is I want to work with Alan Menken. Just leave us alone. He wants to do it. I want to do it. Leave us alone. So I went to work with no contract. Because what Tom told me was Newsies is their most requested title for schools. Because it has all those kids. So for schools to put on and all that, he said, but we have no script to give them. If only we had a script. So Harvey, if you could write a script that we can give to kids, you know, it would be great. You'll make a fortune, blah, blah, blah. And to make a long story short, they told me not to do it. And it's 2 years on Broadway. And got Alan Menken his first Tony Award.
You've been such an advocate for gay rights for a long time. I'm just sensing, even in the last year or two, that there have been so many major changes. Has there been a sigh of relief for you and the community for marriage equality? Sam Champion is out. I mean, the sports figures.
Sam Champion introduced me once and said, you know, and I used to look at Harvey Fierstein as an openly gay person in the media, and I said, funny, I used to look at you the same way. You can fool a doctor, but you can't fool another patient. I knew that the war was won some time ago. These little battles that we're going to have, and they're going to go on for a very long time, but the war really was won as soon as people started seeing gay rights as a civil rights issue. It was always a psychological or sexual issue. When the American Psychiatric Society changed their ruling in the 70s, we were almost there, but people still said, how dare you equate gay rights with black rights, gay rights. And as soon as it became a civil rights issue, I said, our Constitution will not allow it to stay that way, and we will eventually. What makes me laugh is that it's the conservatives that are making us fight every single inch, which is costing a fortune. You know, these people that say we don't want the government wasting money, billions of dollars fighting gay rights, and they lose every battle now. And so, you know, if that's the way they want it, we'll take it. But But the war is won. You know, it's like you know, watching those states try and pass these anti-gay laws is like watching that. You know, we used to have that joke about the little Japanese guy sitting on an island still fighting World War II 50 years later. That's what it's like to me. They just look silly.
And is the battleground now other countries? You've been vocal about the homophobia in Russia as well.
Yeah, well, you know, but I said, and who knew that I turned out to be right? I kept saying, I don't think it has anything to do with us. I said, watch him. He's got something else in mind. I said it in that New York Times piece. I said, I don't think it's anything to do with us. I said, you watch him. Follow the money. Follow his politics. It's just, you know, it's a way people love a common enemy. And it's a way to bring people around so they're not looking over here while his hand is in the cookie jar over here. And I think it turned out to be true. And I laugh. A lot of people criticize me for saying that we should not go to Sochi. They say, well, we'll go to Sochi and we'll be proud and we'll stand there and we'll protest in front of him. Nobody lifted a finger to protest anything. No one did anything.
I want to ask you this because you've talked about your trademark beautiful rasp in the past as sort of double vocal cords that you have. But I looked at clips as far back as I could go, and you've always sounded the same. Did you come out of the womb with this beautiful voice?
No, puberty. I mean, I literally was. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but I was in a professional men's choir, and I was a soprano as a boy. Yeah.
And then when it changed to this. I could go on all night. This has really been amazing. Thank you for watching online. I hope you enjoyed it here. Please join me one more time, the remarkable Harvey Fierstein.
You've been listening to a conversation with actor and playwright Harvey Fierstein. An unedited video of the entire conversation can be seen at thegreenspace.org. Harvey Fierstein's new Broadway play, Casa Valentina, is at Manhattan Theater Club Samuel J. Friedman Theater. Thanks, as always, to the staff and crew of The Green Space, Jennifer Sendro, Nikki Johnson, Nancy Seychow, Ricardo Fernandez, Gaines Laguerre, Chase Colpon, Joanne Klimkovich, David McLean, and Noreen O'Loughlin. For WNYC, I'm Elliot Forrest. Thanks for listening.